This is Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Don Eubanks, Associate Professor at Metropolitan State University and Cultural Consultant.
I'm Marianne Combs, reporter and producer for NPR News.
Luz Maria Frias, Executive Coach and Race Equity Strategist.
Halee Lee, owner of the Other Media Group.
Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the ArtsUS Center for the African Diaspora.
And today we have a special guest with us. We have Mary Kunish Podine, who is a State House representative. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So this week we continue our series on murdered and missing women. This time we look at the experiences of Native women. And today we have Representative Mary Kunish Podine, who authored the legislation creating the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women's Task Force.
So, Representative, one of the things as we dive into the second part of this series is the context around this, right? So many of us are not familiar with all the things that are going into what's happening with murdered and missing women. Can you talk a little bit about how you're seeing this and how you came to know about this issue?
My family, actually, I'm a descendant of Standing Rock Reservation. My grandfather was born out on Fort Berthel and grew up in Standing Rock, came to St. Paul as a young man with his mother and sisters. So understanding our Native heritage was always a very important part of our growing up. And especially as adults, we have tried to keep those connections with our family out on Standing Rock very very close and very clear. I think the situation out at Standing Rock brought more awareness of the violence against women and men and Indigenous folks in general. But what really spurred me to create legislation, to create a task force for missing and murdered Indigenous women, was listening to a radio report coming out of Canada a couple years ago from the BBC around their national study on their missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's probably not a Native family in this state or perhaps even in this country that does not have connections or stories from a lost auntie or great aunt, grandmother. My mother's cousin Elsie went missing and was later found murdered under very suspicious reasons. And those are the stories that are sort of whispered behind the scenes that more and more folks were coming out. And as more people were talking about the fact that historically Native American women experienced violence at extraordinarily higher incidences than any other group, 2 out of 3 Native American women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. And the awareness of this just was pretty horrifying. And I think as more and more Native women and men become more forthright and become more leaders in our communities, we're hearing about it.
I'm sorry, did you say 2 out of 3 women?
Mm-hmm. Yep, 2 out of 3 Native American women. So there are 4 women in this room, at least 2, you know, if not 3 of us will have experienced that. And it's not always on the reservation. We have large populations in cities and in the urban core, as we all know, here in the Twin Cities. And the reports that are coming out are saying that the majority of those incidences are not Native American men. They are men of other nationalities and ethnicities.
These are staggering numbers, and I'm thinking, I want to highlight and call out the importance of you being in office and having a perspective to bring into the House of Representatives and ultimately the legislature and the governor to be able to sign the bill that would create that task force that you'll speak more about. That is the importance of voting for leaders who are representative of our communities, because for generations, these crimes have been happening in Native lands, right, across the country and internationally. Mm-hmm. As we delve into our conversation today, there are stories that we will share about Indigenous women being murdered or missing across the world. We wouldn't be here in Minnesota launching this task force but for your initiative and but for the fact that you have a role at the House of Representatives here in St. Paul that will then enable you to be proactive in seeking out some redress in our communities.
That is so true. I would say that elections really, really, really do make a difference. When I was elected first to the House in 2016, I joined two other Native American women, former Representative Susan Allen. She was the first American woman that was elected to the House of Representatives. And then at that time, our now Lieutenant Peggy Flanagan was a state legislator. Jamie Becker Finn joined me. And four women created the first ever Indigenous caucus at the state capitol.
So talk a little bit about what you're hoping to achieve with this legislation.
The legislation that we created is a task force to study the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Minnesota. And I think by natural progression, we will also be addressing issues with men, boys, and our Two-Spirit communities as well, because again, Indigenous people are incarcerated at higher rates. We experience more violence and have probably the worst education and physical outcomes. Those are the givens. What we need to do is begin to look through past histories and databases and try to come up with some kind of quantitative evidence or information on this, because when I began this and when I started to shop around my legislation, people would say, oh, I didn't know this. How many are we talking about and how long has this been happening? We don't know that. We know that it's been going on forever since, you know, the first colonizers stepped on this continent and sexualized Native American women and then were very intentional about the violence against them, but we can't put a number on exactly how many. There are people that are gathering that information.
That was one of the most surprising things for me as we began to look at these reports. One of the things I kept seeing constantly, there was a couple of kind of mini journalistic documentaries that have been done, and across all of them, I keep hearing this. When I started to go to the data, there's a woman who's doing her doctoral research out of Seattle around this. One of the first things she said is, just, we're not tracking the numbers. These numbers aren't being tracked by the State Department. They're underreported and all these things. And just the consistency of bad data and lack of tracking, it blew me away.
That is absolutely true. And it's not just that we don't have data, but data that has been collected historically is collected in different ways, odd ways. How are you identifying a person? In one state, they use N both for Native American and Negro. Another state would lump East Indian from India people in with American Indian people. And so what we really need to do is build a clean, structured database where all the different agencies, all the different departments are sharing the same information in the same way, and that we're opening up those avenues and those directions of data collection.
What do you hope to do with those numbers?
Sure. So once we have those numbers, you know, data drives decisions, data drives planning. So once we have those, we can come up with, you know, looking at that, where is this happening? Who is this happening to? You know, what are the specific characteristics in that community or in that area of the state that this is happening? For example, Duluth. Duluth has the harbor, and we all know that that is, you know, a direct in and out for sex trafficking. We can say that we know these happen. We have so much anecdotal evidence. We just don't have those numbers. And it's very hard to pull those out of the community because you mentioned that they are underreported. And that leads to the fact that there hasn't always been a good relationship with our police and our professional jurisdiction issues. And it just sort of goes from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And I feel like we're going to have this incredible Venn diagram, you know, at the end of 2 years where everything is interconnecting. And we're going to see those overlaps and start to put in some really good policies and protections for our Indigenous communities.
And I think that one of the issues you point out, in a previous life, I was director of the Chemical Health Division for DHS. And often when the state of Minnesota and others would produce reports that would highlight some of the disparities that exist in our various ethnic subpopulations in Minnesota, there would never be a category for us.
Right.
And so I remember Wilder came in and did one of those reports, and one of the other indigenous staff there asked why we weren't being represented. And often here in Minnesota, you know, because we make up less than probably 1.1 or 1.2% of the total population, the response we got is that our numbers are so small, they are statistically insignificant. And so to hear that, you know, to hear that term used to describe our population, because I remember reading reports at one point in time, and I believe this may have been about 20, 30 years ago, murder was the number one cause of death for our population.
Yep.
And the information you shared, you know, that is so true that, you know, even in my family, you know, we have an incident where I had a cousin move in with us. She had moved down from the Mille Lacs Indian Reservation, and she was with us less than a week, and she was discovered murdered on railroad tracks in St. Paul here. That murder was never solved, and this was back from the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so all of us have these stories of grief, this loss in our community. And part of the issue is that, you know, we've also talked about this in a previous podcast here, how we're the forgotten community. For all intents and purposes, we're invisible.
Mm-hmm. One of the researchers I was looking at, it's a Native woman who's doing this doctoral, and her name is escaping me, so I have to...
Anita.
Look, Anita, thank you. One of the things that she talked about is in looking for the reasons are myriad that she's finding and many folks are finding. But one of the things that's consistent across is something that we talk about across many of our communities. And that is when I marginalize and push to the side and lower your status in comparison to others and otherize you and allow you to be in a position where you are, quote unquote, the missing people, the absent people, right? Then it's a lot easier to do the next things as a vulnerable population, as folks that nobody's going to care about. You know, we know this about predatory behavior in particular, that if I can push you and marginalize you out away and from enough people and kind of get you away from enough people, then it's a lot easier for those predators to move into more egregious actions. And that is, you know, if I can do whatever I want to you because nobody's going to care. And unfortunately, our data is backing this up, that people aren't caring. People aren't following us through. What happens with police reports right away when somebody's reported missing? It's an attribution issue that we have in many of our communities. I attribute your missing or your disappearance to bad behavior of you, your people, your history, your experience. So therefore, I don't treat it the same way I do with other folks where I don't give that attribute.
I think another thing that, you know, I've seen a lot of headlines that like another Indigenous woman has been murdered or missing, right? And then people are just like, oh, that's really sad. And that's kind of like the extent that it gets to. And I think a lot of it is people are confused about the sovereign nation and how law enforcement works inside and outside of that. And so I think, I don't know, I feel like people just assume it's being taken care of by the Indigenous community and that, oh, it's really sad it's happening, but like they're supposed to take care of it, right? Because they're a sovereign nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, jurisdiction is a huge issue when it comes to our Indigenous communities, and especially a very big contributing factor to why we don't know the data or the statistics and why these women and girls and men and boys and two spirits have gone missing without any kind of investigation. Indian reservations are a nation unto themselves, and they have the ability to police their own reservation to an extent. The federal government still has the oversight and the responsibility as well. Then they're coupled with the county, they're coupled with other areas, and the jurisdiction gets very, very sticky. You know, this is, without going into too much detail, Minnesota is considered a public law 280 state, which even makes it more complicated with what the tribal police can address and what the federal bureau is supposed to be responsible for. And it's absolutely true that you can be on Indian land, you can be on a reservation, a man can rape and kill a woman if they're non-native, they're white or whatever, and there's nothing that the reservation police, the tribal police can do because they don't have those kind of abilities by law to do anything. And to your point, That's why the predators do it. That's they know it. Look what happened when there was a discourse between the Mille Lacs County sheriff and the tribal sheriff. And when the county pulled out, immediately there was an uptick in drugs and murder and all of these things because, like, the cartel knew that they could go in there and there would be no consequences at that point.
And this is a very important point. One of the things that both in my preparation for ministry, in my ordination process, and as a youth worker, you know, one of the things that you have to deal with is the fact that we are going to get girls who have been trafficked. And one of the patterns that are commonly reported from youth who I engage is that space. If I can get you to just come to this little thing over here, that forced string out, which is one of the methods that folks use. I can get you strung out. I can get you addicted. And I put you into that position. And I just kind of disappear you through the cartel process, through just neighborhood drug process, or just predators using that as a tool. And again, I don't want to elevate this above all others, but that's something that is commonly reported with some of the youth that we hear the stories from. Mm-hmm.
So if we go back to Don's point that you've made just over the course of the 5 years we've been airing this podcast, that the indigenous community is statistically insignificant and therefore does not appear in various reports, whether state or even federal government. I'm aware of a local campaign that's been just generating in Minnesota, Invisible No More, where there are indigenous leaders who are speaking about more issues and bringing them to light because there's an understanding that historically they've been buried, right? Under any type of news, but also feeling empowered with more representation now in elected offices, whether it's you, Representative Kunesh Podein, or others. Can you speak some more about Invisible No More and what you're familiar with?
Sure. I think one of the really great things that has happened in the last 3 years has been this rise of representation for Native Americans. And of course, the fact that we have now a Native American lieutenant governor. For the very first time ever in the Minnesota House of Representatives, we invited all 11 tribes to come to the House and spend a day on the floor with all of the state representatives. Both sides, everybody was there, and there were 11 tribal leaders that talked about what it's like to be a sovereign nation, the value and the importance of treaties, and how important it is that we acknowledge them and that we uphold those treaties. And when we are trying to pass legislation that has to do with our indigenous community, I have had legislators say, why would we give them more money? We're already giving them more money, when they don't realize that those are the treaty rights. Hmm. And the fact that we have reservations where our Anishinaabe and our Dakota people are supposed to stay on it and somehow create an equitable standard of living, but at the same time, historically underfunded, misused, and took advantage of those kind of communities. And so this movement to make the invisible visible again is an incredible movement because it's bringing forward so much historic trauma, but without those stories being told, without people understanding the real horrors and the pain and the devastation that our indigenous folks have gone through for generation after generation, they won't understand it. The very first hearing we had at the House, representatives around missing and murdered, was incredible. I mean, you could not believe the emotion in that hearing room. And I would say 92% of the people in that room had no idea or understood anything about missing and murdered Indigenous women. It was the first time that they had heard it. We had, you know, a handful of women that told their stories. A couple of them were survivors themselves, had lost children, had lost siblings. And everybody was devastated by this story. And unfortunately, it's those stories that are propelling these kind of movements. If we don't tell the stories, nobody's going to listen.
You know, and I think that one of the reasons that we wanted to do these podcasts, I think, was to bring light to these issues from our communities. And I knew that efforts had happened on the Senate side, but I don't remember anything happening on the House side in terms of tribal leaders coming and having that one day. That one day they get to come in and educate the House and Senate, you know, because this is statewide. I guess the point I was making is that we are here, but we have been that invisible. But I think the women in our community for the past 10 years, if not longer, have been raising this issue, especially around trafficking of indigenous women, because I know there was a lot of work in that arena. And the fact that we now have representations with you and with three other, including Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, you know, raises that awareness. There's so much education that has to happen for the rest of the community, for police departments. When we look at the entire system that's involved with this and has allowed this to happen incognito, there's so much education that has to happen.
I think a lot of education that's happening right now are coming from young Native American women, like you said. I know so many who are always talking about this, who are working towards this, whether they're filmmakers or they run for office where they're from, whether they got elected or not, you know, and it's the same in my community as well. I'm seeing it's like a lot of the violence that happens towards Hmong women, it's the young Hmong women who are coming out and speaking against it. And I think it's somehow has fallen onto the next generation to try to not only bring awareness, but to try to fight it as well.
One of the hard parts about this is part of that process is going to be having to tell these stories. And the representation, you know, goes to making connections to folks that are real. One of the things that we always have to do in these campaigns, whenever we surface a counter narrative like this that dominant culture doesn't know about, is then we are tasked with having to tell the stories and relive these traumatic experiences over and over again. Mm. And so I remember we took groups of students to Standing Rock during some of the height of the pipeline protests that were there. And when we got there, after the children were brought to the sacred fire in the center, the adults were taken and we were given a class. We were given a little mini class there and taught about a whole lot of things. And one of those things was the safety protocols, because while the camp itself was peaceful, it was community, it was awesome, there had to be very clear protocols in place because of the vulnerability that the res was already experiencing with missing and murdered women and young girls. And so the camp was highly alert for that. And I remember a night the alert went through because there was a little girl who could not be found. And the entire camp woke up and put a perimeter around. It was everybody had their marching orders, everybody put in place. It was the most terrifying experience I ever had. It ended up being a miscommunication. But when we got back to the fire after that, I began to get story after story after mm-hmm. story after story about all of these girls who have been missing just in that area as a result of some of the development, you know, because one of the things that happens is in an area where there's development, mining, whatever that is, as the population of folks increase in that area, so too do the numbers of missing folks. So those stories are going to have to be told.
You're listening to Counter Stories on NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, and I'm joined with my co-host and our special guest this hour, State House Representative Mary Konish Podine. Representative, in our last podcast, we met with Andrea Jenkins, Minneapolis City Councilwoman, and talked about violence against trans women, and particularly Black trans women. And she really helped us to understand all the societal factors that put these women in this very fragile, dangerous place where they are so much more vulnerable than other people to this sort of predation and violence. I wonder if you can help us understand, like, what are the systemic problems that you feel need to be addressed to make Native American women safer in their communities, in the cities? And yeah, what are you hoping to combat at the legislative level?
I think a couple of the systemic issues, of course, is the historical trauma of boarding schools mm-hmm. and the destruction of the family unit within our indigenous families. I think it destroyed many generations of women who either wanted to have children or had that maternal instinct to raise children. The propensity towards addiction to self-medicate the pain that has happened. The fact that so many of our indigenous communities up on the reservation have literally been starved both financially and food-wise and medically, and especially around mental health issues, the education system. All of those things have come to a head right now. And those are some of the things that we're going to be looking to address as time goes by. If you start to talk about this topic, inevitably epigenetics will come in. The fact that that kind of historic trauma over generation from generation does change your genetic DNA, and you're passing that on to your children. Mm-hmm. And so as these generations are born and their parents are still trying to deal with their own issues, whether it's trying to find a job, being educated, prejudice is just a natural thing that happens with our Native folks. We're just sort of reinventing ourselves at this point. And so we would like to put in some of the resources, some of the safety nets that are going to help them rebuild and develop strong, healthy families, which we know will then create strong, healthy communities.
So this week, I think, was like the 1 year anniversary of Jamie Kloss's kidnapping. And do you guys remember how big of a deal that was? Mm-hmm. You know, and I just wonder, why aren't we hearing when a young Native girl goes missing? Why aren't we hearing about it to this extent?
That is a good example of how much the media plays into what,
come on,
what we do, what we hear, how our society reacts. One of the things that happened that propelled this task force for me was not just the report coming out of Canada, but at that time was the disappearance of Savannah Graywin in North Dakota, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was going to bring that up.
Here's a beautiful young woman, 8 months pregnant, goes to visit a neighbor. She disappears. Mm. You know, in Indian country, we communicate. You know, Facebook, mm-hmm. Twitter, Messenger, family to family. Hey, there's a kid missing. There's another woman missing. We heard about her missing long before. When I say long, a day, two, three is a long time when somebody is missing, before the media picked it up. And it wasn't really until they found her body in the river and found that the baby had been cut from her womb. With that sensationalism, mm-hmm. oh, now we've got a story. Now we can do something. Oh, we're going to...
If it bleeds, it leads, right?
Now there's something to really work off of. And of course, initially it was young Native woman, single woman. You know, where did she go? A lot of times I have heard from families that when their children or their women go missing and they go to the police... In the past, it was often like, oh, she's probably just out partying. Oh, maybe she's got a new boyfriend. I bet she ran away. Call us when she comes home. One of the women that came forward to tell stories while we were having hearings at the house was a young woman named Dolly Boswell. Her sister JoJo went missing. JoJo had been picked up in Minneapolis and had a short jail time in Owatonna. And when she was released, JoJo called her sister Dolly. They were very close. They spoke a number of times a day. And JoJo said, you know, I've been released. I'm across the street. I'm at this gas station. I'll get a hold of you when I get back into the city. They have never heard or seen from JoJo since then. And when JoJo didn't appear, didn't contact her sister, didn't respond to her sister's emails or phones, Dolly called the police. And the police literally told her that we have better things to do. We're looking for other, you know, young kids. Call us when she gets home. You know, she just got a jail. She's on a JAG or whatever the case may be. They have never seen or heard from her. And the police did not investigate that disappearance.
That issue that you bring up in terms of the lack of impetus or inclination of some police officers to follow up comes up over and over again in a podcast that I'm now listening to, Somebody Knows Something, and it's investigative journalism. And the journalist is David Rijkin, and he's now in the fifth season doing this. He goes around Canada and speaks to families who have had missing and murdered, you know, daughters and mothers and aunties. And it is it's heart-wrenching to hear the stories of these families who have relatives whose bodies may have been found, but the crime has never been solved. And the last one I was listening to has to do with a young girl, Carrie Ann Brown, who went missing as a high schooler. And it's been over 30 years now. Her body was found, but it's been unsolved. And that's hence the title, Somebody Knows Something, is the title of the podcast. And the family described their interaction with the police, and the police did exactly what you just said, which was making excuses and coming up with reasons why their daughter wasn't around. Oh, she went partying, or she was this or that. And the family has a conviction and a sense of urgency to have the investigation start, and it's not. And we know that those critical few hours initially are really instrumental in solving the crime, right? And it's been over 30 years now that this crime has gone unsolved. And the way that trauma is showing up in their family is various ways where family members who are unable to work because they're just so overwhelmed by their loss. Some family members who have relapsed and start self-medicating now with alcohol and other substances. And it is so compelling to hear how traumatized our families in Indian country are, right? Whether it's here in the U.S. or in Canada or other countries. And that's the part that to me at least, is missed by the media. They are not humanizing Indigenous women and girls, and for that matter, men and children as a whole, and communities where there isn't that level of urgency. There isn't that level of visibility, Hilly, that you mentioned earlier. There isn't that level of commitment and drive to really see Indigenous people.
I think that level of outrage is finally rising up to the mainstream media, right? I think we finally get to the point where, like I was saying before, the young women are coming forward and just saying, this will not do. We need to cover this. You know, with social media being an easier way for young people to communicate about things that are happening that they might not see in the mainstream media. But one thing I wanted to ask you guys, especially because we were just talking about mainstream media and how that plays a role in all this. With the popularity of shows like Longmire and Justified, do you think, I mean, I don't watch the shows. I've seen a couple episodes of Longmire. And from what I've seen, not only is a Filipino playing the Native American guy, but a lot of the storyline seems focused around the white sheriff wanting to help the Indian folk on the reservations who don't want their help.
This surfaces a counter narrative I definitely want to bring in, because there's a couple of patterns that literally, just frankly, pissed me off. The first one was the constant pattern of what happens when the report finally does get to news media. I'll give the story of 10 years ago. Alyssa Micklemore was 21, went missing in part of the Aleut tribe in Washington. The first things that came out talked about how she was a young mother and she had all these hardships and stuff like that, which goes into the victim blaming narrative that is picked up all over the place over and over again by media. Before you can even get lines out about a 21-year-old mother going missing, we have all this other stuff that then feeds into this that our biased brain tends to do and say, oh, these are all the reasons why if they weren't this way, then they wouldn't have been in this situation, right? So there's the victim blaming pattern. The other piece that comes in there for me is this idea, this pattern that nobody in Indigenous communities are doing anything about this, which is false. That's complete BS. You know, going back to Alyssa Micklemore, her grandmother and her aunt have been searching for her and bringing other folks to search for her all around. That is actually now creating some kind of watch that's happening, and they're not letting folks forget. And so when you have things like Longmire and kind of the white savior pattern, which also comes in, right? Because with the stories that we do hear when folks finally get involved are the stories of white folks who felt like they needed to get in there. And I've found it infuriating how many stories there are of Native folks who are doing stuff on their own
right.
to do mm-hmm. things. But the stories mm-hmm. that I constantly saw elevated in my Google feed mm-hmm. were white savior folks coming in. Thank you. God bless you for your time and your work. But don't for once think that Native folks aren't trying to rescue their own. That's yeah. just BS.
Yeah. There's a whole centering of the white narrative. It's like it's got to be told from the white person's perspective. And well, I meant well, I was trying hard, or I was the exception. No, I'm the white person has got to be reframed as the good guy in these shows. And it's unfortunate because it doesn't tell history accurately.
And we need that in everybody.
Yeah.
But, there's these patterns that we got to not allow to be acceptable anymore because this is a crisis and we have to treat it as such. And when we allow those things to happen, that comes up.
When we talk about systemic issues, there's also just the perception that we were all taught about Native Americans as we were growing up. You know, those of us who aren't Native American, that you guys, you get money from the casino, so you guys can police yourselves, right? And that they're all just addicts. And that's just something that I think a lot of people in society still have ingrained in their brain. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for them, or maybe because they don't know anyone, because you guys are 1.1% of our population. I don't know. But I think that's something that it surprises me when I meet people who still think that.
Mm-hmm. These patterns, these practices from the treaties, from what you talked about to the predatory acts that were done there, those get ingrained. If the epigenetics ingrain the trauma in us, there is also the ingraining that comes along with having done this over and over again and making it okay in communities who are perpetrators.
Yes.
Well, and there's one thing that you keep saying. There's one word you said like 10 times, that was educate, mm-hmm. right? And we never learned about boarding schools. You know, we were taught like, oh, yeah, and the nice white people, I educated the nice Indian kids, you know? I have a friend who's driving across North Dakota with her kids on a road trip. And her young children had asked her about some folks that she was talking to when they stopped at a convenience store. And, well, what are they? And she said, well, they're Native Americans. And the kids said, no, they're no more Native Americans. Mm. And that's what they were taught. And my friend she decided to homeschool after that. Just that one experience of her kids being, wait, wait, wait. No, Mom, you're wrong. Those people can't be Native American. We were taught that there are no more Native Americans. And so when we say educate, I'm urging everybody listening to this podcast right now to look up what happened in Mankato if you don't know what happened in Mankato, to look up boarding schools if you haven't heard of the atrocities that happened through the boarding schools.
We're not confronting what I think is one of the most important issues that come at the back of all of this history. And that is, what are we doing and what are we saying at all to the condition that says, if I speak truth to this, if I acknowledge and accept this, I have to acknowledge the fact that we have a system set up right now that privileges me to be predatory to these girls on the reservation.
Now you're getting to the root of the issue.
This is something that we keep shying. All the data and stuff that's going to come from this is important, but we've also got to confront the fact that we are enabling predators. Mm-hmm. If at what point does the legislation get to the point of saying a police department, if your response time does not match that of dominant cultural folks, given we know these facts about missing and Native peoples, what accountability can come for you? Because in your doing so, you are actually in action enabling predatory approaches to Native women on a reservation.
And it's not always, I don't want it to paint the picture that our police officers and our federal officers are not responsive or don't care, because when I began this and I went to some of these different agencies and said, would you be willing, if we put this together, would you work on it with me? And they all said yes. And I had police officers at the federal level, at the state level, at the county level, and reservation level, who all will say, the system is so messed up because we have our hands tied. If a person goes missing, we really, like, I don't know if it would be legally or whatever, can't even start looking for that person for 48 hours, and you can prove they've been missing for 48 hours. Think of Greater Minnesota. If a girl goes missing or a woman goes missing, she's reported, and now you have to get the federal government in there. You know, understaffing, jurisdictional issues,
not understanding the community, the terrain. And we talked about if a person goes missing, if a person is murdered and the body is there, how long before the crime scene is decayed or contaminated or compromised. And there's just so many bits and pieces to it. I think, you know, when we want to say what is the reason for all of this, it is predatory men.
Mm-hmm.
It bottom line, mm-hmm. it is men. Mm-hmm. And it is men who know how to work the system. They know how to work communities and women. They know how to work, you know, estrange a girl or a woman from it. You know, I'm just think when we start looking at this, it's going to be Pandora's box.
You bring up a very important point in terms of a response, because I was driving back. I have to go to Chicago periodically to meet with our Episcopal district as I go through this ordination process. I'm driving back, and I stop at the gas station, and I get out, and I see these boys messing with this girl. And the first thought in my mind, so this is the first blinder that I encountered, right, is, oh, they're playing around. Because at this point, she's laughing, but I'm missing all of these signs that I should be stopping, right? So then I turn to keep walking, then I stop and go, wait a minute. I learned to go back and I say, wait. Let me check this out a little bit. And so I said, hey, loud, is authoritative, basing my voice as much as possible, even though I was scared out of my mind because there were six of the boys, right? The little girl runs to a car, clearly with friends, gets in there, and they speed off. And I realize in this moment that I had just was about to walk away and not interrupt what could have been this very situation. It was very clearly a Native young girl.
Mm.
And now I'm going back and saying, I'm looking around going, oh, crap. I look around and there's all kinds of folks around the gas station and everybody else is just going about their business. There was not a stop to turn around and go, wait, what's going on?
Yeah.
I would have never had that response had I not had connection to folks who had made this issue there, right? What is our response going to be when we know we have folks who are showing signs of predatory behavior against young peoples? I have to be on constant alert about that at a youth center. You know, when I see that stuff, I have to confront it. And I could be wrong, and that's great. I'm glad that I am. I have to have the ability and willingness to go and engage in there. And I think you speak to that when you talk about law enforcement. You know, if I'm tied for 48 hours or if I got folks who are not reporting the things that need to get reported when they need to, then I'm also missing a bunch of information that might also write a narrative for me that says that I can stay in my unawareness.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the issues are myriad.
I think for me, one thing that I keep hearing from people who have been through traumatic situations as a child or a young person is the notion that learn to move past your embarrassment and the idea of, oh gosh, you might be wrong. It's okay to be wrong.
Mm.
If you're being wrong in the service of trying to save somebody from a dangerous situation, it's like, embarrass yourself. It's okay. But this notion that we are all so, oh, I'm going to stay with my own affairs. I'm quiet. I don't want to interfere. So I'm just going to walk on by and not hold people accountable for their actions. I think in Minnesota, particularly in our culture, we are so scared of speaking up and speaking out that
there have been a number of high profile instances where flight attendants are able then to spot out girls that are being trafficked,
right,
and have then intervened and stopped that from happening. Before we get further, though, I wanted to raise the issue of VAWA, Violence Against Women Act, right?
Yeah.
And the importance of having that reauthorized. So for listeners who are not aware of the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA as it's regarded, it's coming on its 25th anniversary. And when I was practicing law, we used VAWA with our survivors of domestic violence and other type of criminal activity. But it's my understanding that this year in particular, there were enhancements made, or at least proposed, I should say, to VAWA as it pertains to Indigenous communities as well. And the importance of making sure that we all, as residents of this country, not only support VAWA, but the enhancements that come with it, and make sure that the reauthorization with the resources go through, because it also gets to your point earlier, Representative Kunesh Podein, where you talk about resources within law enforcement and being able to ensure that that is not the impediment to getting the work done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy that we have to have laws or legislation to increase protection against violence for women and children. And that's what VAWA does, especially in Indian land, because there are those jurisdictional issues with the federal government. And the fact that we have to go back and renew it,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we should never have to renew
every
it.
Every 5 years, it's crazy.
Well, we haven't even passed an equal rights amendment as a nation.
Well, I carried that too, and we passed that through the House, so it's up to the Senate right now. So that's a whole nother podcast.
We'll have you back for that one.
Yeah, but the fact that we have to go back and ask for that again and to ensure that there are specific, unique policing efforts and protective efforts for women and children. It just should not ever be like that. So if we have to create those kind of extra layers of protection, then don't make us go back and renew it again and again and again. And so it's absolutely, absolutely vital. Once again, those predators are probably just waiting, you know, licking their lips and rubbing their hands together like, wow, if they don't, man, it's going to be hunting season and it's going to be terrible.
And it doesn't help where we have members of the judiciary who are slapping basically young white men on the wrists
mm-hmm.
when they mm-hmm. have sexually abused, mm-hmm. raped
mm-hmm.
women, and they're getting slaps on the
mm-hmm.
wrists.
Mm-hmm.
What did that one judge say?
It would ruin his
it
life
would ruin
as a
his
as a swimmer or something.
You're talking about Brock Turner.
Yeah,
I'm just saying. And there's been more than one
absolutely.
Instance.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so when we have that kind of climate that is giving this message, particularly to one set of
mm-hmm.
men in this country, but I think that Anthony brought up another topic that I think might be a deeper conversation for us in Counter Stories. Because I can remember my own experience growing up in part of that black community and some of the figures that we looked up to in our community and what the professions that they were in and sexualized women.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot to debunk in terms of how we have, as men, were raised mm-hmm. and nurtured and not nurtured in this country, which is a whole nother
mm-hmm.
podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Representative, you mentioned at the beginning of this hour a BBC News article that you heard that sort of prompted this whole conversation. And I think it might be the one that came out in June of this year that was earlier this year. It said, "The Deaths of Indigenous Women, a Canadian Genocide."
Yeah.
And I think that's the interesting thing is that tying the history of genocide to what continues to be a genocide in our culture today, because it's modern times. We don't think of ourselves, and because it happens every day, we're not seeing it fully for what it is around us. We're not recognizing just the depth of the harm that's being done.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It makes me think of a situation that I had just before session began last time. I also inherited the reparations bill from retired Representative Karen Clark.
Oh.
Karen Clark has handed over some of the work that she's been doing and asked me to carry on. And we had a public meeting around reparations, and we had Native American folks and African American folks from the community there. And the whole story about Fort Snelling actually being a concentration
mm-hmm.
camp.
Mm-hmm.
They forced all these Dakota people off of their lands, and in the middle of winter, it was our own, Trail of Tears made them in the middle of winter camp out down by the river with next to no supplies or protection. So many people died from illness and
from the weather or
from
the people
weather.
Who lost their lives in the conflict.
So, exactly.
And people seeking revenge.
And one of the representatives said, it wasn't a concentration camp, because that's what the elders were calling it, a concentration camp. He's, it wasn't a concentration camp. It might have been concentrated with American Indians, but it wasn't a concentration camp. And you just look, it was just like, oh my gosh, the lens that this person looks through
mm.
to say something like that and would not acknowledge the fact that this was really intentional. Mm-hmm. And this was a concentration camp made up of elderly women and children, the most vulnerable. And you ask why we have, you know, this situation in this day and age. That's a perfect example of what, 2-3 generations ago in our backyard.
So it's been quite a discussion about our missing and murdered Indigenous women. I think that we covered many topics here this evening that are important to Indian country, but important to us as Americans in terms of our humanity and who we are. I'd like to thank House Representative Mary Kunish Podine for joining us today.
And it was my pleasure to be here and talk about this topic that is so important to the health and the well-being of our communities and all of Minnesota.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm Don Eubanks, Associate Professor and Cultural Consultant.
I'm Marianne Combs, Reporter and Producer for NPR News.
Luz Maria Frias, Executive Coach and Race Equity Strategist.
Lee Lee, Owner of the Other Media Group.
Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of ArtsUS.
And State Representative Mary Kunish Podine.
This is Counterstories.